grabbed a wrench. Scott also selected a wrench as they both turned over slowly and rested on their knees. "The jeep has swung across in front of us," said Hannah. "We're going to be forced to stop in about 5 seconds."
"Does it still look as if there are four of them?" asked Scott.
"Yes," said Hannah. "I can't see any more."
The Cadillac came to a halt.
"The jeep has stopped only a few yards in front of us. One of the soldiers is getting out, and another is following. Two are staying in the jeep. One is behind the mounted gun, and the other is still at the wheel. We'll take the first two," said Hannah. "You'll have to deal with the two in the jeep."
"Understood," said Scott.
The first soldier reached the driver's side as the second passed the bumper on Hannah's right. Both Aziz and Hannah had their outside hands on the armrests, their doors already an inch open. The second Aziz saw the first soldier glance into the back and go for his gun, he swung his door open so fast that the crack of the soldier's knees sounded like a bullet as he collapsed to the ground. Aziz was out of the car and on top of him long before he had time to recover. The second soldier ran towards Hannah as Scott leaped out of the car. Hannah delivered one blow to his carotid artery and another to the base of his spine as he tried to pull out his gun. A bullet would not have killed him any quicker. The third soldier started firing from the back of the jeep. Cohen dived out into the road as the fourth soldier jumped from behind the wheel and ran towards him, firing his pistol. Cohen hurled the wrench at him, causing him to step to one side and straight into the firing line of the mounted gun. The bullet stopped immediately, but Cohen was already at his throat. The soldier sank as if he had been hit by a ton of bricks, and his gun flew across the road. Cohen gave him one blow to the jugular vein and another to the back of the neck. He went into spasms and began wriggling on the ground. Cohen quickly turned his attention to the man seated behind the gun, who was lining him up in his sights. At 10 yards distance, Cohen had no hope of reaching him, so he dived for the side of the car as bullets sprayed into the open door, two of them ripping into his left leg. Scott was now running towards the jeep from the other side. As the soldier swung the gun around to face him, Scott propelled himself through the air and onto the top of the jeep. Bullets flew everywhere as they tumbled clumsily off the back, Scott still clinging to his wrench. They were both quickly on their feet, and Scott brought the wrench down across the gunner's neck. The soldier raised an arm to fend off the blow, but Scott's left knee jackknifed into his crotch. The gunner sank to the ground as the second blow from the wrench found its mark and broke the soldier's neck cleanly. He lay splayed out on the road, looking like a breaststroke swimmer halfway through a stroke. Scott stood mesmerized over him, until Aziz dived at his legs and knocked him to the ground. Scott couldn't stop shaking.
"It's always hardest the first time," was the Kurd's only comment.
The four of them were now facing outward, covering every angle as they waited for the locals to react. Cohen climbed unsteadily up into the jeep, blood pouring from his leg, and took his place behind the mounted gun.
"Don't fire unless I say so," shouted Scott as he checked up and down the road. There wasn't a person to be seen in either direction.
"On your left," said Hannah, and Scott turned to see an old man dressed in a long white dishdash with a black and white spotted keffiyeh on his head. A thick belt hung loosely around his waist. He was walking slowly towards them, his hands held high in the air. Scott's eyes never left the old man who came to a halt a few yards away from the Cadillac.
"I have been sent by the village elders because I am the only one who speaks English," he said.
The man was trembling, and the words came stumbling out.
"We believe you are the terrorists who came to kill Saddam."
Scott said nothing.
"Please go. Leave our village and go quickly. Take the jeep, and we will bury the soldiers. Then no one will ever know you were here. If you do not, Saddam will murder us all, every one of us."
"Tell your people we wish them no harm," said Scott.
"I believe you," said the old man. "But please go."
Scott ran forward and stripped the tallest soldier of his uniform, while Cohen kept his gun trained on the old man. Aziz stripped the other three, while Hannah grabbed Scott's bag from the Cadillac before jumping into the back of the jeep. Aziz threw the uniforms into the jeep and then leaped into the driver's seat. The engine was still running. He put the vehicle into reverse and swung around in a semicircle as Scott took his place in the front. Aziz began to drive slowly out of Tuz Kurmatu. Cohen turned the gun around in the direction of the village, at the same time thumping his left leg with his clenched fist.
Scott continued to look behind him as a few of the villagers moved tentatively out into the road and started to drag the soldiers unceremoniously away. Another climbed into the Cadillac and began to back it down a side road. A few moments later, they had all disappeared from sight. Scott turned to face the road ahead of him.
"It's about another 3 miles to the highway," said Aziz. "What do you want me to do?"
"We've only got one chance of getting across that border," said Scott. "So for now, pull over into that clump of trees. We can't risk going out onto the highway until it's pitch dark." He checked the time. It was 7:35. Hannah felt blood dripping onto her face. She looked up and saw the deep wounds in Cohen's leg. She immediately tore off the corner of her yashmak and tried to stem the flow of blood.
"You all right, Cohen?"
asked Scott anxiously.
"No worse than when I was bitten by a woman in Tangier," he replied.
Aziz began laughing.
"How can you laugh?" said Hannah, continuing to clean the wound.
"Because he was the reason she bit me," said Cohen.
After Hannah had completed the bandaging, the four of them changed into the Iraqi uniforms. For an hour they kept their eyes on the road, looking for any sign of more soldiers. A few villagers on donkeys and more on foot passed them in both directions, but the only vehicle they saw was an old tractor that chugged by on its way back to the village at the end of a day's service. As the minutes slipped by, it became obvious that the villagers had kept to their promise and made no contact with any army patrols. When Scott could no longer see the road in front of them, he went over his plan for the last time. All of them accepted that their options were limited. The nearest border was 45 miles away, but Scott now accepted the danger they could bring to any village simply by passing through it. He didn't feel his plan was foolproof, far from it, but they couldn't wait in the hills much longer. It would only be a short time before Iraqi soldiers were swarming all over the area. Scott checked the uniforms. As long as they kept on the move, it would be hard for anyone to identify them in the dark as anything other than part of an army patrol. But once they reached the highway, he knew they couldn't afford to stay still for more than a few seconds. Everything depended on how close they could get to the border post without being spotted. When Scott gave the order, Aziz swung the jeep onto the winding road to begin the 3 mile journey to the highway. He covered the distance in 5 minutes, and during that time they didn't come across another vehicle. But once they hit the highway, they found the road was covered with trucks, jeeps, and even tanks traveling in both directions. None of them saw the two motorcycles, the tank, and 3 trucks that swung off the highway and headed down the little road towards Tuz Kurmatu. Aziz went as fast as he could, while Cohen remained seated on the back behind the gun. Scott watched the road ahead of him, his beret pulled well down. Hannah sat below Cohen, motionless, a gun in her hand. The first road sign indicated that it was 60 kilometers to the border. For a moment, Scott was distracted by an oil well that kept pumping away on the far side of the road. Nobody spoke as the distance to Kirkuk descended from 55 to 46 to 32, but with each sign and each new oil well, the traffic became heavier and their speed began to drop rapidly. The only relief was that none of the passing patrols seemed to show any interest in the jeep. Within minutes, the little village was swarming with soldiers from Saddam's elite guard. Even in the dark, it took only 10 bullets and as many minutes for them to find out where the Cadillac was, and another 30 bullets to discover the unfilled graves of the 4 dead soldiers. General Hamil listened to the senior officer when he phoned in with the details. All he asked for was the radio frequency of the jeep that had been in Tuz Kurmatu earlier that evening. The general slammed down the phone, checked his watch, and keyed in the frequency. The single tone continued for some time. "They must still be looking for a truck or a pink Cadillac," Scott was saying when the radio phone began ringing. They all 4 froze.
"Answer it, Aziz," said Scott. "Listen carefully and find out what you can."
Aziz picked up the handset, listened intently, then said,
"Yes, sir," in Arabic, and put the handset down.
They found the Cadillac and are ordering all jeeps to report to their nearest army post, he said.
It can't be long before they realize it's not one of their men driving this jeep, said Hannah, if they don't already know.
With luck, we might still have 20 minutes, said Scott. How far to the border?
9 miles, said Aziz.
The general knew it had to be Zibari, or he would have immediately responded with the elite guard's code number. So now he knew what vehicle they were in and which border they were heading for. He picked up the phone and barked another order. Two officers accompanied him as he ran out of the room and into a large yard at the back of the building. The blades of his personal helicopter were already slowly rotating.
It was Aziz who first spotted the end of a long line of oil tankers waiting to cross the unofficial border. Scott checked the inside track and asked Aziz if he could drive down such a narrow strip.
Not possible, sir, the young Kurd told him. We'd only end up in the ditch.
Then we've no alternative but to go straight down the middle. Aziz moved the jeep out into the center of the road and tried desperately to maintain his speed. To begin with, he was able to stay clear of the trucks and avoid any oncoming traffic. The first real trouble came 4 miles from the border when an army truck heading towards them refused to move over.
"Shall I blast him off the road?" said Cohen.
"No," said Scott. "Aziz, keep going, but prepare to jump and take cover among the tankers, then we'll regroup." Just as Scott was about to leap, the truck swerved across the road and ended up in the ditch on the far side.
"Now they all know where we are," said Scott. "How many miles to the customs post, Aziz?"
"Three. 3.5 at the most."
"Then step on it," Scott said, although he realized Aziz was already going as fast as he could. They had managed to cover the next mile in just over a minute when a helicopter swung above them, beaming down a searchlight that lit up the entire road. The radiophone began ringing again.
"Ignore it," shouted Scott, as Aziz tried to keep the jeep on the center of the road and maintain his speed.
They passed the 2-mile mark as the helicopter swung back, confident it had spotted its prey, and began to focus its beam directly on them.
"We've got a jeep coming up our backside," said Cohen as he swung around to face it.
"Get rid of it," said Scott.
Cohen obliged, sending the first few shots through the windshield and the next into the tires, thankful for the light from above. The pursuing jeep swung across the road, crashing into an oncoming truck. Another quickly took its place. Hannah reloaded the gun with a magazine of bullets that was lying on the floor, while Cohen concentrated on the road behind them.
1.5 miles to go," shouted Aziz, nearly crashing into trucks on both sides of the road.
The helicopter hovered above them and began to fire indiscriminately, hitting vehicles going in either direction.
"Don't forget that most of them haven't a clue who's chasing what," said Scott.
"Thanks for sharing that piece of logic with me, Professor," said Cohen, "but I've got a feeling that helicopter knows exactly who he's chasing."
Cohen began to pepper the next jeep with bullets the moment it came into range. This time it simply slowed to a halt, causing the car behind to run straight into it and creating an accordion effect as one after another the pursuing jeeps crashed into the back of the vehicle in front of them. The road behind was suddenly clear, as if Aziz had been the last car through a green light.
1 mile to go,"
shouted Aziz as Cohen swung around to concentrate on what was going on in front of him, and Hannah reloaded the automatic gun with the last magazine of bullets. Scott could see the lights of a bridge looming up in front of him. The Kirkuk fortress on the side of the hill that Aziz had told them signaled the customs post was only about 1/2 mile away. As the helicopter swung back and once again sprayed the road with bullets, Aziz felt the front tire on his side suddenly blow as he drove onto the bridge. Scott could now see the Kurdish checkpoint ahead of him as the helicopter swung even lower on its final attempt to stop them. A flurry of bullets hit the jeep's hood, ricocheted off the bridge and into the windshield. As the helicopter swung away, Scott looked up and for a second stared into the eyes of General Hamil. Scott looked back down and punched a hole in the shattered windshield, only to discover he was faced with 2 rows of soldiers lined up in front of him, their rifles aiming straight at the jeep. Behind the row of soldiers were 2 small exits for those wishing to enter Kurdistan, and 2 entrances on the other side of the road for those driving out of Kirkuk. The 2 exits to Kurdistan were blocked with stationary vehicles, while the 2 entrances had been left clear, although no one at that moment was showing any desire to enter Saddam's Iraq. Aziz decided that he would have to swing across the road and risk driving the jeep at an acute angle through one of the small entrances, where he might be faced with an oncoming vehicle, in which case they would be trapped. He was still losing speed and could feel that the rim of the front left-hand wheel was now touching the ground. Once they were within range, Cohen opened fire on the line of soldiers in front of him. Some fired back, but he managed to hit several before the rest scattered. With 100 yards to go and still losing speed, Aziz suddenly swung the jeep across the road and tried to steer it towards the second entrance. The jeep hit the right-hand wall, careened into the short, dark tunnel, and bounced onto the left-hand wall before lurching out into no man's land between the two customs posts. Suddenly there were dozens of soldiers pursuing them from the Iraqi side. "Keep going! Keep going!" shouted Scott as they emerged from the little tunnel. Aziz was still losing speed as he steered the jeep back to the left and pointed it in the direction of the border with Kurdistan, a mere 400 yards away. He pressed his foot flat down on the accelerator, but the speedometer wouldn't rise above 2 miles per hour. Another row of soldiers, this time from the Kurdish border, was facing them, their rifles pointing at the jeep, but none of them was firing. Cohen swung around as a stray bullet hit the back of the jeep, and another flew past his shoulder. Once again he fired a volley towards the Iraqi border, and those who could quickly retreated behind their checkpoint. The jeep trundled on for a few more yards before it finally whimpered to a halt halfway between the two unofficial barriers that the UN refused to recognize. Scott looked towards the Kurdish border. 100 Peshmergas were lined up, their rifles now firing, but not in the direction of the jeep. Scott turned back to see another line of soldiers tentatively advancing from the Iraqi side. He and Hannah began firing their pistols as Cohen let forth another burst which came to a sudden stop. The Iraqi soldiers had started to retreat again, but sensed immediately that their enemy had finally run out of ammunition. Cohen leaped down off the jeep and quickly took out his pistol. "Come on, Aziz," he shouted as he rushed forward and crouched beside the driver's door. "We'll have to cover them so the professor can get his bloody declaration across the border." Aziz didn't reply. His body was slumped lifelessly over the wheel, the horn sounding intermittently. The unanswered radio phone was still ringing. "The bastards have killed my Kurd!" shouted Cohen. Hannah grabbed the canvas bag as Scott lifted Aziz out of the front of the jeep. Together they began to drag him the last few 100 yards towards the border with Kurdistan. Another line of Iraqi soldiers started to advance towards the jeep as Scott and Hannah carried the dead body of Aziz nearer and nearer to his Kurdish homeland. They heard more shots whistle past them and turned to see Cohen running towards the Iraqis, screaming, "You killed my Kurd, you bastards! You killed my Kurd!" One of the Iraqis fell, one retreated, another fell, another retreated, as Cohen went on advancing towards them. Suddenly, he fell to his knees, but somehow he kept crawling forward until a final volley rang out. The sergeant collapsed in a pool of blood a few yards from the Iraqi border. While Scott and Hannah carried the dead Kurd into the land of his people, Saddam's soldiers dragged the body of the Jew back into Iraq.
"Why were my orders disobeyed?" Saddam shouted.
For several moments no one around the table spoke. They knew the chances of all of them returning to their beds alive that night had to be marginal. General Hamil turned the cover of a thick file and looked down at the handwritten note in front of him.
"Major Saeed was to blame, Mr. President," stated the general. "It was he who allowed the infidels to escape with the declaration, and that is why his body is now hanging in Tahrir Square for your people to witness."
The general listened intently to the president's next question.
"Yes, Saeed," he assured his master. "Two of the terrorists were killed by guards from my own regiment. They were by far the most important members of the team. They were the two who managed to escape from Major Saeed's custody before I arrived. The other two were an American professor and a girl."
The president asked another question.
"No, Mr. President. Kratz was the commanding officer, and I personally arrested the infamous Zionist leader before questioning him at length. It was during that interrogation that I discovered that the original plan had been to assassinate you, Saeed, and I made certain that he, like those who came before him, failed."
The general had no well-rehearsed answer to the president's next question, and he was relieved when the state prosecutor intervened.
"Perhaps we can turn this whole episode to our advantage, Saeed."
"How can that be possible?"
shouted the president, when two of them have escaped with the declaration and left us with a useless copy that anyone who can spell British will immediately realize is a fake. No, it is I who will be made the laughingstock of the world, not Clinton.
Everyone's eyes were now fixed on the prosecutor.
That may not necessarily be the case, Mr. President. I suspect that when the Americans see the state of their cherished treasure, they will not be in a hurry to put it back on display at the National Archives.
The president did not interrupt this time, so the prosecutor continued.
We also know, Mr. President, that because of your genius, the parchment currently on display in Washington to an unsuspecting American public is, to quote you, a useless copy that anyone who can spell British will immediately realize is a fake.
The president's expression was now one of concentration.
Perhaps the time has come, Sayedi, to inform the world's press of your triumph.
My triumph?
Said the president in disbelief.
Why, yes, Sayedi. Your triumph, not to mention your magnanimity. After all, it was you who gave the order to hand over the battered declaration to Professor Bradley after the gangster Cavalli had attempted to sell it to you.
The president's expression turned to one of deep thought.
They have a saying in the West, added the prosecutor, about killing two birds with one stone.
Another long silence followed, during which no one offered an opinion, until the president smiled. Part 3. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Chapter 35. The official statement issued by the Iraqi government on July 2nd was that there was no truth in the report that there had been a shooting incident on the border posts at Kirkuk in which several Iraqi soldiers had been killed and more wounded. The Kurdish leaders were unable to offer any opinion on the subject, as the only two satellite phones in Iraqi Kurdistan had been permanently engaged with requests for assistance from the State Department in Washington. When Charles Streeter, the American ambassador in Istanbul, was telephoned and asked by the Reuters bureau chief in the Middle East why a U.S. Air Force jet had landed at the American base in Selope on the Turkish border and then returned to Washington with two unknown passengers as its cargo, His Excellency told his old friend that he had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. The bureau chief considered the ambassador to be an honest man, although he accepted that it was part of the job to lie for his country. The ambassador had, in fact, been up all night following a call from the Secretary of State requesting that one of their helicopters should be dispatched to the outskirts of Kirkuk to pick up five passengers, one American, one Arab, and three Israelis, who were then to be flown back to the base at Selope. The ambassador had called Washington later that morning to inform Warren Christopher that unfortunately only two people had managed to cross the border alive, an American named Scott Bradley and an Israeli woman, Hannah Kopek. He had no information on the other three. The American ambassador was totally thrown by the Secretary of State's final question, did Professor Bradley have a cardboard tube with him? The ambassador was only disappointed that the Reuters correspondent hadn't asked him the same thing, because then he would have been telling him the truth when he said, I've absolutely no idea what you're talking about. Scott and Hannah slept for most of the flight back to the United States. When they stepped off the plane at Andrews Air Force Base, they found Dexter Hutchins at the bottom of the steps, waiting to greet them. Neither of them was surprised when customs showed little interest in Scott's canvas bag. A CIA car whisked them off in the direction of Washington. On the journey into the Capitol, Dexter warned them that they would be going directly to the White House for a top-level meeting and briefed them on who else would be present. They were met at the West Wing reception entrance by the President's chief of staff, who conducted them to the Oval Office. Scott couldn't help feeling that, As it was his first meeting with the president, he would have preferred to have shaved at some time during the last 48 hours, and not to have been dressed in the same clothes that he'd worn for the past 3 days. Warren Christopher was there to greet them at the door of the Oval Office, and he introduced Scott to the president. Bill Clinton welcomed Scott home and thanked Hannah for the part she had played in securing the safe return of the Declaration. Scott was delighted to meet Calder Marshall for the first time, Mr. Mendelssohn for the second time, and to be reunited with Dollar Bill. Dollar Bill bowed to Hannah.
"Now I understand why the professor was willing to cross the earth to bring you back," was all the little Irishman had to say.
The moment the handshakes were over, none of them could hide their impatience to see the Declaration. Scott unzipped his bag and carefully took out a bath towel, from which he extracted the document before handing it over to its rightful custodian, the Secretary of State. Christopher slowly unrolled the parchment. No one in the room was able to hide their dismay at the state the Declaration was in. The Secretary passed the document over to the archivist, who, accompanied by the conservator and Dollar Bill, walked across to the large window overlooking the South Lawn. The first word they checked was British, and the archivist smiled. But it was only a few moments more before Calder Marshall announced their combined judgment.
"It's a fake," was all he said.
"How can you be so certain?" asked the president.
"May I fake it?" said Dollar Bill, looking a little sheepish.
"So does that mean that Saddam is still in possession of the original?" asked the Secretary of State in disbelief.
"No, sir. He has the copy Scott took to Baghdad," said Dollar Bill. "So clearly he was already in possession of a fake before Scott did the exchange."
"Then who has the original?" the other four asked in unison.
"Alfonso Mario Cavalli would be my guess," said Dollar Bill.
"And who's he?" asked the president, no wiser.
"The gentleman who paid me to make the copy that is currently in the National Archives," said Dollar Bill, "and to whom I released the only other copy which I am now holding in my hands."
"But if the word British is spelled with two T's, how can you be so certain it's a fake?" asked Dexter Hutchins.
"Because of the 56 signatures on the original declaration, six have the Christian name George. Five of them signed G.E.O., which was the custom of the time. Only George Wythe of Virginia appended his full name. On the copy I presented to Cavalli, I made the mistake of also writing G.E.O. for Congressman Wythe, and had to add the letters R.G.E. later. Although the lettering is perfect, I used a slightly lighter shade of ink. A simple mistake, and discernible only to an expert eye."
"And even then only if they knew what they were looking for," added Mendelssohn.
"I never bothered to tell Cavalli," continued Dollar Bill, "because once he had checked the word British, he seemed quite satisfied."
"So at some time Cavalli must have switched his copy with the original and then passed it on to Al Obeidi," said Dexter Hutchins.
"Well done, Deputy Director," said Dollar Bill.
And Al Obeidi, in turn, handed the copy on to the Iraqi ambassador in Geneva, who had it delivered to Saddam in Iraq. And since Al Obeidi had seen Dollar Bill's copy on display at the National Archives, with British spelled correctly, he was convinced he was in possession of the original, said Dexter Hutchins.
"You've finally caught up with the rest of us," said Dollar Bill. "Though, to be fair, sir, I should have known what Cavalli was capable of doing when I said to you a month ago, 'Is there no longer honor among thieves?'"
"So where is the original now?" demanded the president.
"I suspect it's hanging on a wall in a brownstone in Manhattan," said Dollar Bill, "where it must have been for the past 10 weeks.
The light on the telephone console to the right of the president began flashing. The president's chief of staff picked up an extension and listened. The normally unflappable man turned white. He pushed the hold button.
"It's Bernie Shaw at CNN for me, Mr. President. He says Saddam is claiming that the copy of the Declaration of Independence on display at the National Archives is a fake, and that anyone who can spell British would realize it. Do you have any comment to make?"
The president pursed his lips.
My bet is that Saddam has given CNN an exclusive on this story, but probably only until tomorrow, the chief of staff added.
Whatever you do, said Hutchins, try to keep it off the air for tonight.
The chief of staff hesitated for a moment until he saw the president nodding his agreement. He pressed the button to re-engage the call.
If you want to go on the air with a story like that, Bernie, it's your reputation on the line, not mine.
The chief of staff listened carefully to Shaw's reply while everyone else in the room waited in silence.
Be my guest, were the last words the chief of staff offered before putting the phone down.
He turned to the president and told him, Shaw says he will have a crew outside the National Archives the moment the doors open at 10 tomorrow morning, and, I quote, if the word British is spelled correctly, he'll crucify you. The president glanced up at the carriage clock that stood on the mantelpiece below the portrait of Abraham Lincoln. It was a few minutes after 7. He swiveled his chair around to face the deputy director of the CIA.
Mr. Hutchins, he said, you've got 15 hours to prevent me being crucified. Should you fail, I can assure you there won't be a second coming for me in 3 years, let alone 3 days.
Chapter 36. The leak started in the early morning of Sunday, July 4th, in the basement of number 21, the home of the Prestons, who were on vacation in Malibu. When their Mexican housekeeper answered the door a few minutes after midnight, she assumed the worst. An illegal immigrant with no green card lives in daily fear of a visit from any government official. The housekeeper was relieved to discover that these particular officials were only from the gas company. Without much prompting, she agreed to accompany them down to the basement of the brownstone and show them where the gas meters were located. Once they had gained entry, it only took a few moments to carry out the job. The loosening of two gas valves ensured a tiny leak, which gave off a smell that would have alarmed any layman. The explosives expert assured his boss that there was no real cause for concern as long as the New York City Fire Department arrived within 20 minutes. The senior official calmly asked the housekeeper to phone the fire department and warn them they had a gas leak in number 21, which, if not dealt with quickly, could cause an explosion. He told her the correct code to give. The housekeeper dialed 911, and when she was finally put through to the fire department, stammered out the problem, adding that it was 21 East 75th between Park and Madison.
Get everyone out of the building, instructed the fire chief, and we'll be right over.
Yes, sir, said the housekeeper, not pausing for a moment before fleeing onto the street.
The expert quickly repaired the damage he had caused, but the smell still lingered. To their credit, 7 minutes later, a New York City fire department hook and ladder, sirens blasting, sped into 75th Street. Once the fire chief had carried out an inspection of the basement of number 21, he agreed with the official, whom he had never met before, that safety checks would also have to be carried out on numbers 17, 19, 23, and 25, especially as the gas pipe ran parallel to the city's sewage system. The deputy director of the CIA then retired to the far side of the road to watch the fire chief go about his work. Since the sirens had woken almost everyone in the neighborhood, it wasn't proving too hard to coax the residents out onto the street. Dexter Hutchins lit a cigar and waited. As soon as he had left the White House, he had begun rounding up a select team of agents who rendezvoused in a New York hotel 2 hours later for a briefing, or, to be more accurate, half a briefing. Because once the deputy director had explained to them that this was a level 7 inquiry, the old-timers realized they would be told only half the story and not the better half. It had taken another 2 hours before they got their first break, when one of the agents discovered that the Prestons in number 21 were on vacation. Dexter Hutchins and his explosives expert had arrived on the doorstep of number 21 just after midnight. The Mexican immigrant without a green card turned out to be a bonus. The deputy director relit his cigar, his eyes fixed on one particular doorway. He breathed a sigh of relief when Tony Cavalli and his father emerged in their bathrobes, accompanied by a butler. He decided it would be sensible to wait for another couple of minutes before he asked the fire chief's permission to inspect number 23. The whole operation could have been underway a lot earlier,
If only Calder Marshall hadn't balked at the idea of removing the fake declaration from the vault of the National Archives and placing it at Dexter Hutchins's disposal. The archivist made two stipulations before he finally agreed to the deputy director's request. Should the CIA fail to replace the copy with the original before 10 o'clock the following morning, Marshall's resignation statement, dated May 25th, would be released an hour before the President or the Secretary of State made any statement of their own.
"And your second condition, Mr. Marshall?"
the President had asked.
"That Mr. Mendelssohn be allowed to act as custodian of the copy remaining with the Deputy Director at all times, so that he will be present should they locate the original."
Dexter Hutchins realized he had little choice but to go along with Marshall's conditions. The deputy director stared across at the conservator, who was standing between Scott and the explosives expert on the pavement opposite number 23. Dexter Hutchins had to admit that Mendelssohn looked more convincing as an official from the gas company than anyone else in his team. As soon as Hutchins saw two of his agents emerging from number 19, he stubbed out his cigar and strolled across the road in the direction of the fire chief. His three colleagues followed a few paces behind.
"All right for us to check on number 23 now?" he asked casually.
"Fine by me," said the fire chief, "but the owners are insisting the butler sticks with you."
Hutchins nodded his agreement. The butler led the four of them into the lobby, down to the basement, and directly to the cupboard that housed the gas supply. He assured them that there had not been the slightest smell of gas before he went to bed, sometime after his master had retired. The explosives expert carried out his job deftly, and in moments the basement stank of gas. Hutchins recommended to the butler that for his own safety he should return to the street. With a handkerchief covering his nose and mouth, Martin reluctantly agreed, leaving them to try and locate the leak. While the expert repaired the damage, Scott and Dexter began checking every room in the basement. Scott was the first to enter Cavalli's study and discover the parchment hanging on the wall, exactly where Dollar Bill had promised it would be. Within seconds, the other two had joined him. Mendelssohn stared lovingly at the document. He checked the word British before lifting the glass frame gently off the wall and placing it on the boardroom table. Scott unzipped the large tool bag one of the agents had put together earlier in the evening, containing screwdrivers of all sizes, knives of all lengths, chisels of several widths, and even a small drill, in fact everything that would be required by a professional picture framer. The conservator checked the back of the frame and requested a medium-sized screwdriver. Scott selected one and passed it across to him. Mendelssohn slowly and methodically removed all eight of the screws that held the two large steel clamps to the back of the frame. Then he turned the glass over on its front. Dexter Hutchins couldn't help thinking that he might have shown a little more sense of urgency. The conservator, oblivious to the deputy director's impatience, rummaged around in the bag until he had selected an appropriate chisel. He wedged it between the two pieces of laminated glass at the top right-hand corner of the frame. At the same time, Scott extracted from the cylinder supplied by Mendelssohn the copy of the declaration they had taken from the National Archives earlier that evening. When the conservator lifted the top piece of the laminated glass and rested it on the boardroom table, Scott could tell from the smile on his face that he believed he was staring down at the original.
"Come on," said Dexter, "or they'll start getting suspicious."
Mendelssohn didn't seem to hear the deputy director's urgings. He once again checked the spelling of British and, satisfied, turned his attention to the five GEOs and one George before glancing first quickly and then slowly over the rest of the parchment. The smile never left his face. Without a word, the conservator slowly rolled up the original, and Scott replaced it with the copy from the National Archives. Once Scott had the sheets of glass back in position, he screwed the two steel clamps firmly in place. Mendelssohn deposited the cylinder in the tool bag while Scott hung the copy on the wall. They both heard Dexter Hutchins's deep sigh of relief.
"Now, for Christ's sake, let's get out of here," said the deputy director, as six cops, guns drawn, burst into the room and surrounded them.
"Freeze," said one of them.
Mendelssohn fainted. Chapter 37. All four were arrested, handcuffed, and had their rights read to them. They were then driven in separate police cars to the 19th precinct. When they were questioned, three refused to speak without an attorney present.
The fourth pointed out to the desk sergeant that if the bag which had been taken from him was opened at any time other than in the presence of his attorney, a writ would be issued and a separate action taken out against the NYPD. The desk sergeant looked at the smartly dressed, distinguished-looking man and decided not to take any risks. He labeled the bag with a red tag and threw it in the night safe. The same man insisted on his legal right to make one phone call. The request was granted, but not until another form had been completed and signed. Dexter Hutchins put a collect call through to the director of the CIA at 2:27 that morning. The director confessed to his subordinate that he hadn't been able to sleep. He listened intently to Hutchins's report and praised him for not revealing his name or giving the police any details of the covert assignment. "We don't need anyone to know who you are," he added. "We must be sure at all times not to embarrass the president." He paused for a moment. "Or, more important, the CIA." When the deputy director put the phone down, he and his three colleagues were hustled away to separate cells. The director of the CIA put on his bathrobe and went down to his study. After he had written up a short summary of the conversation he had had with his deputy, he checked a number on his desk computer. He slowly dialed the 212 area code. The commissioner of the New York City Police Department uttered some choice words when he answered the phone, until he was sufficiently alert to take in who it was sounding so wide awake on the other end of the line. He then switched on the bedside light and began to make some notes on a pad. His wife turned over, but not before she had added a few choice words of her own. The director of the CIA ended his part of the conversation with the comment, "I owe you one." "Two," said the commissioner. "One for trying to sort out your problem." "And the second?" asked the director. "For waking up my wife at 3 o'clock in the morning." The commissioner remained seated on the edge of the bed while he looked up the home number of the captain in charge of that particular precinct. The captain recognized his chief's voice immediately when he picked up the phone and simply said, "Good morning, Commissioner," as if it were a routine mid-morning call. The chief briefed the captain without making any mention of a call from the director of the CIA or giving any clues about who the four men languishing in his night cells were, not that he was absolutely certain himself. The captain scribbled down the salient facts on the back of his wife's copy of Good Housekeeping. He didn't bother to shower or shave, and dressed quickly in the clothes he had worn the previous day. He left his apartment in Queens at 3:21 and drove himself into Manhattan, leaving his car outside the front of the precinct a few minutes before 4. Those officers who were fully awake at that time in the morning were surprised to see their boss running up the steps and into the front hall, especially since he looked disheveled, unshaven, and was carrying a copy of Good Housekeeping under his arm. He strode into the office of the duty lieutenant, who quickly removed his feet from the desk. The lieutenant looked mystified when asked about the four men who'd been arrested earlier, since he'd only just finished interrogating a drug pusher. The desk sergeant was called for and joined the captain in the duty lieutenant's office. The veteran policeman, who thought he had seen most things during a long career in the force, admitted to booking the four men, but remained puzzled by the whole incident, because he couldn't think of anything to charge them with, despite the fact that one of the homeowners, a Mr. Antonio Cavalli, had called within the last few minutes to ask if the four men were still being held in custody as a complication had arisen. None of the residents had reported anything stolen, so theft did not apply. There could be no charge of breaking and entering, as on each occasion they had been invited into the buildings. There was certainly no assault involved, and trespass couldn't be considered, as they had left the premises the moment they were asked to do so. The captain didn't show any interest in whether or not the desk sergeant could find something to charge them with. All he wanted to know was, "Has the bag been opened?" "No, Captain," said the sergeant, trying to think where he had put it. "Then release them on bail pending further charges," instructed the captain. "I'll deal with the paperwork." The paperwork took the captain some considerable time, and the four men were not released until a few minutes after 6. When they ran down the precinct steps together, the little one with the pebble-rimmed glasses was clinging firmly to the unopened bag. Antonio Cavalli woke with a start. Had he dreamed that he'd been dragged out of bed and onto the street in the middle of the night? He flicked on the bedside light and picked up his watch. It was 3:57.
He began to recall what had taken place a few hours earlier. Once they were out on the street, Martin had accompanied the four men back into the house. Too many for a simple gas leak, Cavalli had thought. And what gas company employee would smoke cigars and could afford a Saks Fifth Avenue suit? After they had been inside for 15 minutes, Cavalli had become even more suspicious. He asked the fire chief if the men were personally known to him. The chief admitted that, although they had been able to give him the correct code over the phone, he had never come across them before. He decided Mr. Cavalli was right when he suggested that perhaps the time had come to make some checks with the gas company. Their switchboard informed him that they had no servicemen out on call that night on 75th Street. The fire chief immediately passed this information on to the police. A few minutes later, six police officers had entered number 23 and arrested all four men. After they had been driven away to the station, his father and Martin had helped Tony check every room in the house, but as far as they could see, nothing was missing. They had gone back to bed around 1:45. Cavalli was now fully awake, though he thought he could hear a noise coming from the ground floor. Was it the same noise that had woken him? Tony checked his watch again. His father and Martin often rose early, but rarely between the hours of 3 and 4. Cavalli swung out of bed and placed his feet on the ground. He still felt sure he could hear voices. He slipped on a bathrobe and walked over to the bedroom door. He opened it slowly, went out onto the landing, and peered over the balustrade. He could see a light shining from under the door of his father's study. Cavalli moved swiftly down the one flight of stairs and silently across the carpeted hallway until he came to a halt outside the study. He tried to remember where the nearest gun was. He listened carefully but could hear no movement coming from inside. Then, suddenly, a gravelly voice began cursing loudly. Tony flung open the door to find his father, also in his bathrobe, standing in front of the Declaration of Independence and holding a magnifying glass in his right hand. He was studying the word British. "Are you feeling all right?" Tony asked his father.
"You should have killed Dollar Bill when I told you to,"
was his father's response. "But why?" asked Tony.
"Because they've stolen the Declaration of Independence."
"But you're standing in front of it," said Tony.
"No, I'm not,"
said his father.
"Don't you understand what they've done?"
"No, I don't," admitted Tony.
"They've exchanged the original for that worthless copy you put in the National Archives."
"But the copy on the wall was the other one made by Dollar Bill," said Tony. "I saw him present it to you."
"No," said his father. "Mine was the original, not a copy."
"I don't understand," said Tony, now completely baffled. The old man turned and faced his son for the first time.
"Nick Vicente and I switched them when you brought the declaration back from Washington."
Tony stared at his father in disbelief.
"You didn't think I'd allow part of our national heritage to fall into the hands of Saddam Hussein?"
"But why didn't you tell me?" asked Tony.
"And let you go to Geneva knowing you were in possession of a fake while the deal still hadn't been closed? No, it was always part of my plan that you would believe the original had been sent to Franche-Charles-C, because if you believed it, Al Obeidi would believe it."
Tony said nothing.
"And you certainly wouldn't have put up such a fight over the loss of $50 million if you'd known all along that the document you had in Geneva was a counterfeit."
"So where the hell is the original now?" asked Tony.
"Somewhere in the offices of the 19th Precinct would be my bet," replied his father. "That is, assuming they haven't already got clean away. And that's what I intend to find out right now," he added as he walked over to his desk and picked up the phone book.
The chairman dialed 7 digits and asked to speak to the duty officer. He checked his watch as he waited to be put through. It was 4:22. When the desk sergeant came on the line, Cavalli explained who he was and asked 2 questions. He listened carefully to the replies, then put the phone back on the hook. Tony raised an eyebrow.
"They're still locked up in the cells, and the bag's been placed in a safe. Have we got anybody on the 19th Precinct payroll?"
asked his father. "Yes, a lieutenant who's done very little for us lately."
"Then the time has come for him to pay his dues,"
said his father as he began walking towards the door. Tony passed him, taking the stairs 3 at a time on the way back to his bedroom. He was dressed within minutes and walked back down the staircase, expecting to have to wait some time for his father to reappear, but he was already standing in the hallway. His father unlocked the front door, and Tony followed him out onto the sidewalk, passing him to look up the street in search of a yellow cab. But none chose to turn right down 75th Street at that time in the morning.
"We'll have to take the car,"
shouted his father, who had already begun to cross the road in the direction of the all-night garage.
"We can't afford to waste another minute.
Tony dashed back into the house and removed the car keys from the drawer of the hall table. He caught up with his father long before he reached their parking space. As Tony fastened his seatbelt, he turned and asked his father, "If we do manage to get the declaration back, what the hell do you intend to do then?"
"To start with, I'm going to kill Dollar Bill myself, so I can be certain that he never makes another copy. And then..."
Tony turned the key in the ignition. The explosion that followed woke the entire neighborhood for the second time that morning. The four men came running down the precinct steps. The smallest of them was clutching a bag. A car whose engine had been running for the past hour swung across the road and came to a halt by their side. One of the men walked off into the half-light of the morning, still not certain why his expertise had been required in the first place. Dexter Hutchins joined the driver in the front, while Scott and the conservator climbed quickly into the back. "LaGuardia," said Dexter, and then thanked the agent for sitting up half the night. Scott looked between the two front seats as the digital clock changed from 6:11 to 6:12. The agent swung into the outside lane. "Don't break the speed limit," ordered Dexter. "We don't need any more delays at this stage." The agent edged back into the center lane. "What time's the next shuttle?" asked Scott. "Delta, 7:30, replied the driver. Dexter picked up the phone and punched in 11 numbers. When a voice at the other end said, "Yes," the deputy director simply replied, "We're on our way, sir. We should have everything back in place by 10 o'clock. Dexter replaced the phone and turned around to assure himself that the silent conservator was still with him. He was clutching the bag that was resting on his legs. "Better take everything out of the bag other than the cylinder," said Dexter. "Otherwise, we'll never get past security." Mendelssohn unzipped the bag and allowed Scott to remove the screwdrivers, knives, chisels, and finally the drill, which he placed on the floor between them. He zipped the bag back up. At 6:43, the driver pulled off the highway and followed the signs for LaGuardia. No one spoke until the car came to a halt at the curb opposite the Marine Air Terminal entrance. As Dexter stepped out of the car, three men in tan Burberrys jumped out of a car that had parked immediately behind them and preceded the deputy director into the terminal. Another man in a smart charcoal gray suit with a raincoat over his arm held out an envelope as Dexter passed him. The deputy director took the package like a good relay runner without breaking his stride as he continued towards the departure lounge where three more agents were waiting for him. Once he had checked in, Dexter Hutchins would have liked to pace up and down as he waited to board the aircraft. Instead, he stood restlessly 1 yard away from the Declaration of Independence, surrounded by a circle of agents. "The shuttle to Washington is now boarding at gate number 4, announced a voice over the intercom. Nine men waited until everyone else had boarded the aircraft. When the agent standing by the gate nodded, Dexter led his team past the ticket collector, down the boarding ramp and onto the aircraft. They took their seats, 1A through F and 2A through F. Seat 2E was occupied only by the bag, 2D and 2F by two men who weighed 500 pounds between them. The pilot welcomed them aboard and warned them there might be a slight delay. Dexter checked his watch, 7:27. He began drumming his fingers on the armrest that divided him from Scott. The flight attendant offered every one of the nine men in the first two rows a copy of USA Today. Only Mendelssohn took up her offer. At 7:39, the aircraft taxied onto the runway to prepare for takeoff. When it stopped, Dexter asked the flight attendant what was holding them up. "The usual early morning traffic," she replied. "The captain has just told me that we're seventh in the line, so we should be airborne in about 10 to 15 minutes. Dexter continued drumming his fingers on the armrest while Scott couldn't take his eyes off the bag. Mendelssohn turned another page of his USA Today. The plane swung around onto the takeoff runway at 7:51, its jets revving before it moved slowly forward, then gathered speed. The wheels left the ground at 7:53. Within moments, the flight attendant returned, offering them all breakfast. She didn't get a positive response until she reached row 7. When later she gave the three crew members on the flight deck their usual morning coffee, she asked the captain why rows 3 to 6 were unoccupied, especially as it was Independence Day. The captain couldn't think of a reason and simply said, "Better keep your eye on the passengers in rows 1 and 2. He became even more curious about the nine men at the front of the aircraft when he was cleared for landing as soon as he announced to air traffic control that he was 70 miles away from Washington. He began his descent at 8:33 and was at the gate on schedule for the first time in months. When he had turned the engine off, three men immediately blocked the gangway and remained there until the deputy director and his party were well inside the terminal. When Dexter Hutchins emerged into the Delta Gate area, one agent played John the Baptist, while three others fell in behind, acting as disciples. The director had obviously taken seriously that fine line between protection and drawing attention. Dexter spotted four more agents as he passed through the terminal and suspected there were at least another 20 hidden at strategic points on his route to the car. As Dexter passed under the digital clock, its red numbers clicked to 901. The doors slid open and he marched out onto the sidewalk. Three black limousines were waiting in line with drivers by their doors. As soon as they saw the deputy director, the drivers of the first and third cars jumped behind their wheels and turned on their engines, while the driver of the second car held open the back door to allow Scott and Mendelssohn to climb in. The deputy director joined the agent in the front. The lead car headed out in the direction of the George Washington Parkway, and within minutes the convoy was crossing the 14th Street Bridge. As the Jefferson Memorial came into sight, Dexter checked his watch yet again. It was 9:12. "Easily enough time," he remarked. Less than a minute later, they were caught in a traffic jam. "Damn," said Dexter. "I forgot the streets would be cordoned off for the Independence Day parade." When they had moved only another half a mile in the next 3 minutes, Dexter told his driver they were left with no choice. "Hit the sirens," he said. The driver flashed his lights, turned on his siren at full blast, and watched as the lead car veered into the inside lane and managed a steady 40 miles per hour until they came off the highway. Dexter was now checking his watch every 30 seconds as the three cars tried to maneuver themselves from lane to lane, but some of Washington's citizens, unmoved by sirens and flashing lights, weren't willing to let them through. The lead car swerved between two police barriers and turned into Constitution Avenue at 9:37. When Dexter saw the floats lining up for the parade, he gave the order to turn the sirens off. The last thing he needed was inquisitive eyes when they finally came to a halt outside the National Archives. It was Scott who saw them first. He tapped Dexter on the shoulder and pointed ahead of him. A television crew was standing in the front of a long line outside the main door of the National Archives. "We'll never get past them," said Dexter. Turning to Mendelssohn, he asked, "Are there any alternative routes into the building?" "There's a delivery entrance on 7th Street," replied Mendelssohn. "How appropriate," said Dexter Hutchins. "Drive past the front door and then drop me off on the corner," said the conservator. "I'll cross Constitution and go in by the side door." "Drop you off on the corner?" said Dexter in disbelief. "If I'm surrounded by agents, everyone will..." began Mendelssohn. "Yes, yes, yes," said the deputy director, trying to think. He picked up the phone and instructed the two other cars to peel off. "We're going to have to risk it," said Scott. "I know," said Dexter, "but at least you can go with him. After all, you've never looked like an agent." Scott wasn't sure whether he should take the remark as a compliment or not. As they drove slowly past the National Archives, Dexter looked away from the impatient camera crew. "How many of them?" he asked. "About six," said Scott, "and I think that must be Shaw with his back to us." "Show me exactly where you want the car to stop," said the deputy director, turning to face Mendelssohn. "Another 50 yards," came back the reply. "You take the bag, Scott." "But," began Mendelssohn. When he saw the expression on Dexter Hutchins's face, he didn't bother with a second word. The car drew into the curb and stopped. Scott grabbed the bag, jumped out, and held the door open for Mendelssohn. Eight agents were walking up and down the sidewalk, trying to appear innocent. None of them was looking towards the steps of the National Archives. The two unlikely-looking companions quickly crossed Constitution Avenue and began running up 7th Street. When they reached the delivery entrance, Scott came face to face with an anxious Calder Marshal, who had been pacing back and forth at the bottom of the ramp. "Thank God," was all the archivist said when he saw Scott and the conservator running down the ramp. He led them silently into the open freight elevator. They traveled up two floors and then ran along the corridor until they reached the staircase that led down to the vault. Marshall turned to check that the two men were still with him before he began running down the steps, something no member of staff had ever seen him do before. Scott chased after the archivist, followed by Mendelssohn. None of them stopped until they reached a set of massive steel doors. Marshall nodded, and a slightly breathless conservator leaned forward and pressed a code into a little box beside the door. The steel grid opened slowly to allow the three of them to enter the vault. Once they were inside, the conservator pressed another button and the door slid back into place. They paused in front of the great concrete blocks that had been built to house the Declaration of Independence, just as a priest might in front of an altar. Scott checked his watch. It was 9:51. Mendelssohn pressed the red button, and the familiar clanking and whirling sound began as the concrete blocks parted and the massive empty glass casing came slowly into sight. He touched the button again when the frame had reached chest height. The archivist and the conservator walked forward while Scott unzipped the bag. The archivist took two keys from his jacket pocket and passed one over to his colleague.
they immediately set about unlocking the 12 bolts that were evenly spaced around the thick brass rim. Once they had completed the task, they leaned over and heaved across the heavy frame until it came to rest like an open book. Scott removed the container and passed it over to the archivist. Marshall eased the cap off the top of the cylinder, allowing Mendelssohn to carefully extract the parchment. Scott watched as the archivist and the conservator slowly unpeeled the Declaration of Independence inch by inch onto the waiting glass until the original parchment was finally restored to its rightful place. Scott leaned over and took one last look at the misspelled word before the two men heaved the brass cover back into place.
"My God, the British still have a lot to answer for," was all the archivist said.
Calder Marshall and the conservator quickly tightened up the 12 bolts surrounding the frame and took a step back from the declaration. They paused for only a second while Scott checked his watch again, 9:57. He looked up to find Marshall and Mendelssohn hugging each other and jumping up and down like children who had been given an unexpected gift. Scott coughed. "It's 9:58, gentlemen." The two men immediately reverted to character. The archivist walked back over to the concrete blocks. He paused for a moment and then pressed the red button. The massive frame rose, continuing its slow journey upward to the gallery on the ground floor to be viewed by the waiting public. Calder Marshall turned to face Scott. A flicker of a smile showed his relief. He bowed like a Japanese warrior to indicate that he felt honor had been satisfied. The conservator shook hands with Scott and then walked over to the door, punched a code into the little box, and watched the grid slide open. Marshall accompanied Scott out into the corridor, up the staircase, and back down in the freight elevator to the delivery entrance. "Thank you, Professor," he said as they shook hands on the loading dock. Scott loped up the ramp and turned to look back once he had reached the sidewalk. There was no sign of the archivist. He jogged across 7th Street and joined Dexter in the waiting car. "Any problems, Professor?" asked the deputy director. "No, not unless you count two decent men who look as if they've aged 10 years in the past 2 months." The 10th chime struck on the old post office tower clock. The doors of the National Archives swung open, and a television crew charged in. The deputy director's car moved out into the center of Constitution Avenue, where it got caught up between the floats for Tennessee and Texas. A police officer ran across and ordered the driver to pull over into 7th Street. When the car came to a halt, Dexter wound down his window, smiled at the officer, and said, "I'm the deputy director of the CIA. "And I'm Uncle Sam," the officer replied, as he began writing out a ticket. Chapter 38. The deputy director of the CIA phoned the director at home to tell him that it was business as usual at the National Archives. He didn't mention the traffic ticket. The conservator phoned his wife and tried to explain why he hadn't come home the previous night. A woman holding a carrier bag with a rope handle contacted the Iraqi ambassador to the UN on her mobile phone and let him know that she had killed two birds with one stone. She gave the ambassador an account number for a bank in the Bahamas. The director of the CIA rang the Secretary of State and assured him that the document was in place. He avoided saying, "back in place." Susan Anderson rang Scott to congratulate him on the part he had played in restoring the document to its rightful home. She also mentioned in passing the sad news that she had decided to break off her engagement. The Iraqi ambassador to the UN instructed Monsieur Dumont to transfer the sum of $900,000 to the Royal Bank of Canada in the Bahamas and at the same time to close the Al Obeidi account. The Secretary of State rang the President at the White House to inform him that the press conference scheduled for 11 o'clock that morning had been canceled. A reporter on the New York Daily News, Crime Beat, filed his first edition copy from a phone booth in an underground garage on 75th Street. The headline read, "Mafia Slaying in Manhattan." Lloyd Adams's phone never stopped ringing as he was continually being offered parts in everything from endorsements to a feature film. The archivist did not return a call from one of the president's special assistants at the White House inviting him to lunch. A CNN producer called in to the news desk to let them know that it must have been a hoax. Yes, he had verified the spelling of British, and only Dan Quayle could have thought it had two T's. Scott phoned Hannah and told her how he wanted to spend Independence Day.
The End.